Up comes now, Democracy Now!
For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This kind of attack was expected because of what the Israelis were doing in Gaza, what the Ansar Allah group were doing in Yemen with their missile attacks and drone attacks against ships, what the American Navy and Air Force have been doing in the Red Sea, attacking Yemen. And this is part of a regional war.
A drone strike at a base in Jordan near the Syrian and Iraq border kills three U.S. soldiers, injuring more than 30. The Pentagon's accusing Iran-backed militants, while Iran denies any involvement. We'll speak with Palestinian-American journalist Rami Khoury about U.S. Middle East policy. Then, hours after the International Court of Justice orders Israel to take all measures to prevent genocide in Gaza, arguments in another genocide case began in a U.S. federal court in Oakland against President Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. We'll speak with a lawyer who helped bring the case and a Palestinian who testified. And as Israel intensifies attacks on southern Gaza, where displaced Palestinians have sought refuge, we'll speak with an emergency room physician who spent 3 weeks at a hospital in Khan Yunis.
Nasser Hospital was recently the focus of a very intense military campaign with bombing and gun clashes, as well as tanks rolling in around the hospital vicinity. And hundreds of thousands of people fled from Khan Yunis further south to Rafah. And so the humanitarian crisis in Gaza has deepened.
We'll also speak with the Norwegian Refugee Council's Jan Egeland about the U.S. and 12 other nations suspending funding to UNRWA, the U.S. Agency for Palestinian Refugees, after Israel accuses 12 UNRWA employees of taking part in the Hamas attack on October 7th. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon's accused Iranian-backed militants of killing three U.S. soldiers and injuring 34 others in a drone strike at a base in Jordan near the Syrian and Iraq border. On Sunday, President Biden vowed the U.S. would respond, quote, at a time and in a manner of our choosing, unquote. The attack comes less than a month after a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad killed the head of an Iranian-backed militia. A group called the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has claimed responsibility for attacking the U.S. forces in Jordan. Iran's denied any involvement. In a statement, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq said, quote, if the U.S. keeps supporting Israel, there'll be escalation. All U.S. interests in the region are legitimate targets, and we don't care about U.S. threats to respond, unquote. The drone strike was the first fatal attack on U.S. forces in the Middle East since Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th. Two U.S. Navy SEALs died January 11th. After going overboard while raiding a ship suspected of carrying Iranian arms off the coast of Somalia. In Gaza, Israeli attacks have killed at least 373 Palestinians since Friday, when the International Court of Justice ordered Israel to take all possible measures to prevent genocide in Gaza. In another major development, the United States and at least 12 other nations have suspended funding to UNRWA. That's the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, after Israel accused 12 employees of the agency of taking part in the Hamas attack on October 7th. UNRWA is one of the largest employers in Gaza, with a staff of over 13,000. It provides essential aid to most of Gaza's 2.3 million residents. The agency responded to Israel's allegations by firing 9 employees. The head of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, condemned the freezing of funds at a time when famine is looming in Gaza. He said, quote, Palestinians in Gaza did not need this additional collective punishment. This stains all of us, he said. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya urged countries to reverse their decision to freeze UNRWA funds.
The suspension of aid is in line with the Israeli plans for the forced evacuation of our people from Gaza into Egypt. The suspension of aid comes at the most difficult times, at a time when the International Court of Justice has called for an immediate supply and increase supplies and international aid into Gaza. UNRWA provide aid for 1.7 million Palestinians in Gaza.
Norway is continuing to fund UNRWA. We'll speak with the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, later in the broadcast. In other news on Gaza, CIA Director William Burns is taking part in talks in Paris with officials from Israel, Egypt and Qatar over a proposed deal involving the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza in exchange for a two-month pause to Israel's assault. Thousands of Israelis gathered in Jerusalem on Sunday for a major conference calling for Palestinians to be removed from Gaza in order to rebuild Jewish settlements. Speakers at the conference included Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Israel's Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich.
We are settling our land from width to length, controlling it and fighting terror always and bringing, with God's help, security to all of Israel. You know what the answer is. Without settlement, there is no security.
A group of Palestinian Americans asked a federal judge Friday to bar the United States from providing military, financial, and diplomatic support to Israel for committing genocide in Gaza. The Biden administration's asked the judge to dismiss the case, which was brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights. One of the lawyers in the case, Mark van der Hoot, spoke outside the federal courthouse in Oakland, California, Friday.
We are very hopeful. We think the evidence was overwhelming. The government, the administration did not even contest, really, that there was genocide going on. They just say, judge, whatever is going on, whether it's 20,000 or 30,000 or 50,000 or 200,000 or 2.2 million people who are ultimately killed, you can't do anything, judge. Nobody can do anything. It's the president can do whatever the hell he wants. And what do we say to that? We say, hell no.
In related news, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's urged the FBI to investigate pro-Palestinian protesters calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Without sharing any evidence, Pelosi claimed on CNN the protesters may have ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Pelosi said, quote, for them to call for ceasefire is Putin's message. A federal jury ordered Donald Trump to pay E. Jean Carroll $83.3 million in damages for defaming her in 2019 while he was president of the United States. This comes on top of the $5 million in damages he was ordered to pay Carroll last year by another jury when he was found liable for sexually abusing her in the 1990s and defaming her. In a statement, E. Jean Carroll said, quote, this is a great victory for every woman who stands up when she's been knocked down and a huge defeat for every bully who's tried to keep a woman down, unquote. Trump said he will appeal Friday's ruling. Meanwhile, in a separate case, a judge is expected to rule this week on a $370 million civil fraud suit brought against Trump by New York Attorney General Letitia James. The Biden administration approved a $23 billion deal to sell F-16 fighter jets to Turkey. The State Department notified Congress of its decision Friday, just days after Turkish lawmakers voted to allow Sweden to join NATO. A Kenyan court blocked a plan to send 1,000 Kenyan police officers to Haiti to help combat gang violence, ruling the move was unconstitutional. The UN Security Council approved the mission last year. Kenyan forces were due to deploy as early as this month. In Haiti, the reaction to the news was mixed, as some residents have called for foreign intervention amidst the spiraling violence. Others have rejected any outside actors coming to Haiti.
The crisis is a Haitian crisis. I remember in 2005 through 2006, when the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti arrived in Haiti, they left behind children, diseases like cholera, and they left many children without dads. Today, if we are united, we can do wonders.
Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso announced they are withdrawing from ECOWAS. That's the Economic Community of West African States. All three countries are led by military governments following coups in recent years. The nations released a joint statement accusing the 15-country bloc of being, quote, under the influence of foreign powers, betraying its founding principles and becoming a threat to its member states and its population, unquote. Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso have expelled the military of their former colonizer, France, and were already suspended by ECOWAS in the wake of the military takeovers. In a major victory for the climate movement, the Biden administration Friday paused approvals for new liquefied natural gas, or LNG, export terminals. The move comes after years of organizing by activists and frontline Gulf communities who've decried the projects as carbon megabombs. This is Rochetta Sibley-Ozan of the environmental justice organization The Vessel Project.
Being a mom of six children living in this community where my children have asthma and other skin conditions that they are battling every day, I know that these facilities are not in the public interest. Living in a community that smells like rotten eggs and chemicals, I know that these facilities are not in the public interest. But this pause is not just a minor achievement. It is a significant milestone. It sets the stage for potential rejections and slows down the progress of these projects.
And in related news, a Louisiana court okayed environmental permits for a new Formosa plastics facility in St. James Parish. It would be the country's largest plastics plant. The area located along the Mississippi River is already known as Cancer Alley due to the many toxic chemical plants that have sickened the majority black population. Residents and activists have vowed to keep fighting the proposed Formosa plant. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The first U.S. troops have been killed by enemy fire in the Middle East since Hamas attacked Israel October 7th. The Pentagon's accusing Iranian-backed militants of killing three U.S. soldiers in a drone strike at a base in Jordan along the Syrian border. The attack reportedly also injured 34 other U.S. troops. On Sunday, President Biden vowed the U.S. would respond, quote, at a time and in a manner of our choosing, unquote. The attack comes less than a month after a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad killed the head of an Iranian-backed militia. A group called the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has claimed responsibility for the attack and released video of the attack. It says shows the group attacking the American military base. In a statement, the group said, quote, if the U.S. keeps supporting Israel, there will be escalations. All U.S. interests in the region are legitimate targets, and we don't care about U.S. threats to respond, they say. For more, we're joined by Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at American University of Beirut. His recent piece for Al Jazeera headlined Watching the Watchdogs, the five Ds of U.S. Middle East policy, Washington's delusion, denial, dishonesty, distortion, and diversion have had disastrous consequences for the region. Rami, welcome back to Democracy Now! So if you can talk about this latest attack, three U.S. soldiers dead, 34 wounded, the wounded being medevaced back to the United States. Talk about the significance of who's claimed responsibility and what this means for a possible escalating regional conflict.
Thank you. Glad to be with you again. And great to see a show like yours doing such a wide range of coverage of important issues, which is rare on American TV. I'm happy to be with you. So I would say that the significance here is several-fold. First of all, the people who did this attack, the Americans blame a certain group in Iraq funded or backed by Iran. There's dozens of these groups all over the region. There's almost as many of these groups around the region as there are American military bases around the region. I think there's something like 30 or 35 American military bases with something like 30, 40,000 troops. And of course, when you add the ones that come in on the aircraft carriers, it's more than that. So what you have to see this, you have to see this in the context of a regional situation with many American military installations, some of them killing and attacking Arabs and others, some of them are not. And you have to see the groups from Arab countries, official state groups and non-state actors like Hezbollah and Hamas and Ansarullah. That's the context in which we have to see this. There are so many potential people who could have done this attack, which should make us wonder about why are there so many people who are potential attackers. It's because they see the American presence linked very close to what Israel is doing in Palestine. They see this as a threat, and they come right out and say it. The thing about the Islamic resistance in Iraq, like the resistance axis, which is the broader Middle East coalition of Hezbollah, Hamas, Ansarullah in Yemen, the Islamic groups and resistance groups in Syria and Iraq, their significance is that they come right out, and they've said it so many times, we're not scared of being attacked. We're not put off by the U.S. And Israeli threats. We're defending our territory, and if we're aggressed against, we're going to fight back. This is unusual in this region, but it's going on all the time. The Ansarullah in Yemen have been saying the same thing. The U.S. went in there with, and the U.K., the two great colonial powers in the Middle East of the last century, both have been attacking Ansarullah targets in Yemen, and the Ansarullah people say, you know, go ahead, attack, we don't care. And they keep attacking back and hitting ships and trying to fire other places as well. So that's the context that we have to look at. And it's some of it is linked to Gaza. Some of it was there before Gaza, which is another important thing. And the Ansarullah in Yemen and others have said, look, if the U.S. stops actively supporting the genocidal, savage moves of Israel and Gaza, we will stop attacking American targets. It is significant that this is the first direct strike that killed three Americans, but that's not as significant as the broader picture that we have to look at.
Rami Khoury, can you talk about the other countries and their response and where they stand vis-a-vis the United States and Israel? For example, Jordan. I listened to the Jordan deputy prime minister yesterday saying this did not happen on Jordanian soil. It happened in Syria. But in fact, it looks like it did happen in Jordan. And why that was relevant, because, of course, they're all very close right there on the border, as he said, if it happened on Jordanian soil, they would consider it an act of war.
Yeah, Jordan tries to stay out of these big conflicts. It's a small country. It has quite a sophisticated military capability. They spend a lot of money and attention on their security services, both internally and regionally, their intelligence services, their technical capabilities, special forces, things like that. And they try to not get directly involved in large-scale warfare, but to do a little strategic pinpoint actions when necessary, either to protect themselves or to help their allies like the U.S. And others. It's hard to know exactly where this attack came from. If the U.S. intelligence agencies have the information, they should make it public so people stop speculating. But Jordan is a country with a huge territory on the borders with three, four countries, and it's very hard to patrol it. By the way, I know that area in northeastern Jordan quite well. I spent many, many days there years ago when I was writing books on archaeology, and I lived in Jordan. And there's two things I think people should recognize about this area. First of all, if you look at that aerial photograph, which you showed, of the camp, Tower 2, I think it's called, if you look at that photograph, then you go back into the archaeological journals and look at pictures, aerial photographs of Roman and Byzantine camps that archaeologists have mapped in surveys, you find exactly the same thing. And this is a sign that these kinds of foreign military installations inside the region, especially on peripheral border areas, don't have a long lifestyle. And they will be abandoned because the local people don't want them there. Mm-hmm. So that second thing I'd say, that area is really fascinating because, you know, people call it a desolate desert area. It's a desert area now because of climate change and overgrazing and things like that. But this was a strategically important region in the beginning of modern civilization as we know it in the Bronze Age. There's people who think that the Abraham's path came through here on his way into the what's known as the Promised Land, that this is an area developed early urbanism in the Bronze Age, walled large towns, sophisticated water systems, showing the human capabilities that have been in this area for about 5,000 years. So those are just two little side points I'd like to throw in there.
I have a last question. Trita Parsi, one of the heads of the Quincy Institute, a well-known Iranian-American author and analyst, talking about the U.S. soldiers who died, said they didn't die defending U.S. interests. They died defending Biden's refusal to press Israel for a ceasefire. Their lives were put at risk by Biden to defend Israel's ability to continue its carnage in Gaza. If you could respond to that, and among other things, 1,000 black pastors across the political spectrum, representing hundreds of thousands of congregants in the black community in the United States, calling on Biden, who are normally mainly constituents of Biden, supporters of Biden, for a ceasefire. This issue of rather than doing what the Republicans like Lindsey Graham and Senator Cornyn are calling for, bomb Iran, are saying go the other way as a result of this.
Yeah, those are two really important points. On the point of the black pastors, and they represent, I think, around a couple hundred thousand parishioners, they now join the Arab American and Muslim American groups located all over the country with a epicenter in Michigan, who are also telling Biden the same thing, that we're not going to vote for you if you keep being a part of the genocide in Gaza that Israel is performing. So this is significant because it's showing us that American politicians really don't care about morality or the law. They care about electoral incumbency and staying in power, which is probably what all politicians do, to be fair. Americans are no different. So this is a question now that is raised with the death of the three Americans and I think 24 injured. And there'll be more of these attacks for sure. Because keep in mind, the axis of resistance and these groups, the Islamic resistance in Iraq and in Syria, openly say, attack us, we don't care, you're not going to frighten us. And this is unusual. So the question is, are American troops now in the Red Sea, in Iraq, possibly in other places, dying for the sake of Israel? Israel wants an American-Iranian confrontation. They've openly tried to do it, and the Americans have been thoughtful, unusually, in the Middle East by resisting a full-scale war with Iran. But the question becomes, all these actions, are they for the sake of Israel? And not just Israel, but a right-wing fascist majority that now is has been said by the UN's highest court, the world's highest court, to be involved in genocide? Or is this really about U.S. strategic interests? U.S. strategic interests have not been well served by the 35, 40 military bases the U.S. has around the region. And remember, this Islamic resistance in Iraq and Syria, it emerged out of the destruction that happened in Iraq after the American invasion of Iraq, to topple Saddam Hussein. The chaos that happened after that created a lot of these groups. Some of them are tribal, some of them are ideological, some of them were Iranian-linked, and some of them were American-supported. They're all, you know, they have all kinds of patrons. But all of this goes back to what the U.S. did in Iraq to a very large extent. And therefore, the U.S. really needs to listen to people like Trita Parsi and others to look at what are we doing in the Middle East. Is this really the best thing for America's well-being? Or are we serving the interests of Israelis? And if we are, why are we doing that? Is it, and as the black pastors are suggesting, is it maybe for electoral purposes? Is it for selfish political reasons? In the U.S., these linkages now are becoming much more clear. They're controversial. They're sensitive. But they have to be addressed. And there is a possibility to stop all this militarism, which is the ceasefire that can be installed now quickly if the U.S. wants, and then moving quickly to a permanent peace negotiation, which will require new leaders in Israel and in Palestine and other places, more credible leaders, but a negotiated peace that resolves the fundamental Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the wider Arab-Israeli conflict, which will not need 35, 40 American bases and constant, never-ending warfare. And this process is going to go on. It's going to keep expanding if we're not careful. I don't think we're going to get to a full-fledged war with Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah and others fighting against the U.S. and Israel. That would be a catastrophe for the whole region. I don't think we're going to get there. But what we have now is a low-intensity diversified regional warfare, and I think that's going to continue.
Rami Khoury, I want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian-American journalist, senior policy, public policy fellow at American University of Beirut, speaking to us from Boston. Up next, hours after the International Court of Justice ordered Israel to prevent genocide in Gaza, another genocide case was brought against the Biden administration. It was heard in Oakland, California. Stay with us. Clash, who am I? If I could speak to a younger me, I would rewrite my history and tell me that you're beautiful because you're alive.
Imagine me, not for what I see when I never look at me because I imagine me, little praise, no insecurities, I finally have me collapse, I imagine
me. She always wanna have blue eyes, an oxymoron like true lies, fighting demons inside, using lightning and cream to hide a complexion, killing itself from the inside. She couldn't handle the sunshine, her skin developed a cancer in the enzymes. What she thought was the answer had now threatened to cancel the melanin that's protecting her. It's a thin line, deeply affected her when her husband died. Her innermost insecurities got magnified. African woman lost in the shadow of white supremacy, with the light of your skin to be and be glorified. Generations and centuries we've been victimized, started viewing ourselves through our oppressor's eyes. I wrote
Blue Eyes by Vic Mensa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Just hours after the International Court of Justice in The Hague ordered Israel to take all measures to prevent genocide in Gaza, but stopped short of calling for a ceasefire, a hearing in another genocide case began here in the United States. The Center for Constitutional Rights first filed the case in November against President Joe Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. For 3 hours on Friday, in a federal courtroom in Oakland, California, Palestinians and Americans testified in person and by phone from Gaza about the Biden administration's failure to prevent what they called the, quote, unfolding genocide in Gaza. Lawyers for the Biden administration say the court lacks proper jurisdiction to decide the case, which they argue is a matter of foreign policy. The judge said, quote, "This probably is the most difficult case factually that this court has ever had." For more, we're joined by two guests. Leila Al-Haddad is a Palestinian writer and journalist from Gaza who testified in court Friday, author of Gaza Mom, Palestine Politics, Parenting, and Everything in Between, and co-editor of the book Gaza Unsilenced with Rafat Al-Arir, the Palestinian academic and activist killed in December by an Israeli airstrike in Gaza, along with his brother, his sister, and her four children. Also joining us is Diala Shamas, senior state attorney, staff attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Diala, why don't you start off by laying out the case?
Thank you for having me, Amy. Yeah, so we filed this case in November, laying out all of the ways in which the U.S. government, this Biden administration in particular, President Biden, Secretaries Blinken and Austin, have failed in their duty to prevent an unfolding genocide in Gaza, but also are complicit in a genocide in Gaza. And a couple of days after filing our complaint, sought a preliminary injunction, which is essentially an emergency order, saying to the court, you know, the stakes here are so high. The harms to our plaintiffs, the Palestinians, who are plaintiffs in this case, and we have two human rights organizations with staff in Gaza that are plaintiffs, along with a number of individuals, some of whom are Palestinian Americans with families in Gaza, many of whom have been killed and displaced and are, you know, suffering all of the conditions that we have all come to know all too well. And we also have plaintiffs